stories carry with them great power.
They can transport us into the light and into the dark.
And into a place in between, a land of shadows.
It is in this land where the macabre and the strange reign.
With tales of terror,
tales of hope,
tales of the whimsical,
and the weird.
These are stories told in the shadows.
And we are the Shadow Storytellers. Think about the last time you went out with friends. Do you think those friends would describe that day the same way you would? Agree on where you went to eat and who really said that perfect one-liner? What about the time before? Or the time before that? Details go missing quickly, replaced by rational and likely guesses. So when you think about the strangest, most impossible memory you have left, who's to say the reality wasn't even more bizarre and horrifying? Hold tight to your objectivity as we squint backward 20 years in part one of the two-part story we call The Last Time I Went to the Mall.
Have you ever seen the movie Dawn of the Dead? I don't mean the remake Zack Snyder did back in 04. I'm talking the original by George Romero, released in 1978. If you haven't, and you're into some classic horror and some pretty gnarly gore effects, I highly recommend it. As a kid who got to know horror via primitive website descriptions and recording movies off of TV onto iffy VHS tapes, it was a formative movie in my development as a horror fan, and in my humble opinion, unquestionably one of the greatest horror movies ever made. I know, it doesn't hold up to a lot of today's horror. The dialogue is cheesy and heavy-handed, its pacing is all over the place, and Tom Savini's legendary gore effects, groundbreaking though they were at the time, show the film's limited budget in all its goofy glory. It doesn't make me love it any less as a movie, and I will defend it and quote it till the bitter end. However, I'll admit that of all the lines that stuck with me, it's one of the little throwaway quotes that always made me giggle. Early on as they're approaching the Monroeville Mall for the first time, one character asks what they're looking at. Another responds by explaining to their newfound apocalypse buddy that what they're seeing is an indoor mall. For a teenager who came of age in the late 90s and early 2000s, that was the peak of hilarity to me. Our local mall, the Braywood Courtyard Shopping Center, was such a center of my and my friends' lives that the idea of a time and place where malls were that utterly alien to anyone just seemed so impossibly ludicrous that all I could do was laugh at it. Yeah, I know. I had a lot to learn, but what teenager doesn't? I know now that my time spent enjoying malls happened not long after the beginning of their heyday, and as it turned out, not long before the end of it either. Young me would never have believed in the possibility that shopping malls would be in their death rattle stages by the time I was getting married and planning on having kids of my own. Young me would never have believed all the empty stores, or that the big department stores would be gasping for dear life. No, I wouldn't have believed any of it. Now, I won't say I'm not for progress, because I am. I understand why malls are failing, and that my Amazon Prime subscription is probably not helping matters any. But even if it's just a natural evolution of a changing technological environment, there's a part of me that's really going to miss them. After all, where else will teenagers go on awkward first dates where they can have a food court, movie theater, and bowling alley all within walking distance? Yeah, I have a lot of good memories of my teenage years hanging out at the Braywood Courtyard Shopping Center with my friends, Lindsay and Marco, Will and Riley. The kinds of memories I wouldn't trade for anything. They aren't the only memories of the mall I have, though. I've got my bad memories, too. Memories of assholes in the audience making it hard to watch movies. Memories of heartbreak, of fights with friends and things I wished I hadn't said. And then there are the darker memories. The memories that led to the end. These are memories I have a hard time pinning down. I know memory is a funny thing, and that the older you get, the fuzzier certain things can be. So there are times I have my doubts that these things actually happened. Sometimes the memories begin to fade, falling apart like rice paper the moment I reach out to touch them. It's times like this that I separate myself from memory and look for the newspaper articles. They bring the memories back to life and remind me of what happened, of the horror, of what happened with Roland Buckman on that night my friends and I vowed never to return to this mall that had been our home away from home for so many years. when I see the state the Braywood Courtyard Shopping Center is in today, well, let's just say I think it's for the best that this particular mall is dying. Purely at a glance, there is little to separate the Braywood Courtyard Shopping Center from any other mall built in the 80s. It has the typical white concrete boxy structures with decades-faded tinted glass. If you were to see it from above in a satellite picture, you'd see a design something like a blocky four-leafed clover. Three of the leaves would be the standard big-name department stores, while the fourth contains the food court, movie theater, and a variety of Instagram-friendly places for hipsters to play video games and go bowling. In the center is a glass-domed rotunda that is decorated for every holiday, major and minor alike, and when there's no holiday in close proximity, it acts as something of an open gallery for local artists. In the corridors connecting the leaves are the smaller shops, selling last season's hottest clothes, toys, and electronics at this season's prices. Surrounding the mall are seemingly miles of black asphalt parking lots, and while I remember them being packed when I was a kid, you'd be lucky to see them a third of the way full even during peak Christmas shopping season these days. These are facts about the Braywood Courtyard Shopping Center, those things that are undeniable and observable and easily verified. Everything else? Well, that's where it starts to get a little more complicated, because there are very few things that anyone seems to agree about regarding this peculiar little mall. First and foremost is the fact that it's difficult to prove whether or not the place actually exists. I mean, yes, it exists on this physical plane. You can go there and see it and get a corn dog at the hot dog on a stick like you can at any other mall in America. But from a legal standpoint, the place shouldn't be there. Checking the public records, the plot of land it's on isn't granted to any person or entity, nor are there any building permits authorizing its construction. Ask around the town of Braywood itself, and those who are old enough will give different dates as to when it was opened. I've heard dates ranging from 1979 to 1985, with the highest level of agreement seeming to settle around sometime in late 1981. Even so, I haven't come across a single person who remembers the place being built, or was involved in any way in its construction, which for a town that mostly seems to be made of old-timers holding on to the past has always struck me as a little odd. I'll admit that this alone is hardly proof of anything sinister going on at the Braywood Courtyard Shopping Center. Paperwork can be lost, and, like I said before, memory's a funny thing that gets fuzzier the more years you put behind you. I don't have that many decades behind me, and even my memory of everything that ever happened at the mall isn't exactly the greatest. But I know I've seen enough to state that, even ignoring everything that happened the night Roland Buckman disappeared, the mall was at the very least a profoundly odd place. Take, for example, its name. I'm not talking about the words or even the letters in it, no, not exactly, but the printed name on the east side of the mall. My friends and I used to have a game we'd play sometimes where, before we'd go into the mall, we'd debate for a few minutes what exactly the font on the side of the mall actually looked like. I always saw it in understated, plain black lowercase letters, like many a late 80s store would have. Lindsay would say with absolute certainty that it was big and bold in all caps, while Marco would invariably insist that it was red and italicized. One time, out of pure curiosity for this odd phenomenon, I handed all of my friends a piece of paper and a pen to try to draw what they saw, and by the time we were finished, there were five separate and completely different-looking drawings of what the mall's name looked like. For the longest time, I thought that it was maybe an optical illusion, or maybe all of my friends just banding together to play one hell of an elaborate, if weird, practical joke on me. But once I had some years behind me and the courage that came with age, I started asking strangers I met outside the mall what they thought the name looked like, and even then I've never yet gotten a consistent answer. Such small oddities like this persisted inside the mall. For all of the time we spent there and all of the maps posted around the place, my friends and I would frequently get lost. Stores would never be quite where we remembered them to be, and I can never remember there being a consistent layout to the restaurants in the food court, even if all the restaurants themselves remained the same. Sure, we mostly went to the mall to wander and people watch, but this was an annoying trait whenever we actually wanted to find something. The employees were never of much help either. So many of them seemed in a daze at any given moment, pale and sweaty, doing little more than their jobs and barely doing them at that. I can't say I blame them for being like this, though, since the mall's environment was always a little difficult to become accustomed to. The synth-pop music in the background was low, but clear enough that you always knew how atonal and discordant it was. All the plants in the planters were unusually fragrant, sometimes overpoweringly so. And the lights... Now, I've worked enough office jobs to know the hell of working beneath fluorescent lights, but the lights in the Braidwood Courtyard Shopping Center were something else entirely. They were slightly too blue, slightly too soft, and they behaved oddly with shadows. Shadows would just, well, seemingly do whatever they wanted if you paid enough attention. They would be slightly off-kilter, sometimes going in the opposite direction of where they ought to have, and I swear there was more than one occasion where I could see someone's shadow sticking to a wall for a few seconds before quickly catching up with its host. I can see this now clearly in my mind's eye, and I know it's impossible, but the moment I would step inside the walls of the shopping center, shadows that didn't behave right just seemed normal. So, yeah, I can see why working in a place like this wasn't the best for employees. My friend Riley worked there for a month back in sophomore year, and she told me stories of people walking around in a daze, a lot of them with strange rashes or sores, and some of the real lifers at the place were missing teeth, hair, and fingernails, or looking like they had arms longer than usual, or heads that were slightly asymmetrical and too large. Now, Riley was a bit of a stoner, and a fairly playful one at that, so it was easy to write this off as the paranoia kicking in. But now... Well, I guess I understand why she only lasted a month. I know I make it sound bad, and the easy question is why the hell we kept going back there even knowing what we knew about the place. But the answer is, well, we were young, and our options were few. The mall was a safe place for us to hang out and have fun and ignore the pressures of school and family for just a little while. While we were there, we were our own nation, far away from families and responsibilities and truly understanding what it felt like to be free. Yeah, we knew that things could be abnormal there sometimes in ways that seemed to defy any conventional understanding of logic, but we were having fun, and it wasn't hurting us. It couldn't have been that bad, right? This all held until January of 2002, when the five of us got together to celebrate Will's 17th birthday, and everything went oh so very wrong. Life has taken me on some twists and turns over the slow crawl toward adulthood, some of which have been more useful than others in my grown-up life. Getting my degree in history, but not in teaching, is definitely one of those less useful turns. You see, I graduated high school in that time when going to college was still seen as thoroughly necessary, the difference between guaranteed failure and guaranteed success, no matter what kind of success you dreamed of, or what you actually studied. I liked history well enough, and studying it was as fun as it was challenging, but nowadays it's just an unimpressive footnote on my slightly less unimpressive resume. While it may not get me the best of jobs, I will forever be grateful for the life skills it taught me, in particular, the ability to step back and do my best to get perspective on anything I approach to see the big picture when possible. It's with that eye that I can say that there has never really been a best time to be alive, since there's always some kind of shit or another making life on Earth miserable, but within the limited scope of the first half of my life, I can say there was no time for misery quite like those first few months after 9/11. Watching the news day in, day out, being constantly reminded to never forget what had happened and the heroes who had given their lives for this country. It was like living in a cloud of gloom 24/7, where it felt almost like a betrayal to those who had died to have anything like light in our lives. I remember seeing my classmates sleepwalking from class to class, persistently on the verge of breakdown. My friends and I, we coped as best we could. Riley self-medicated with a whole lot of weed, and that seemed to work pretty well for her. Marco tried his hand at some pretty intense poetry, and while he was never going to win any awards, I wasn't going to begrudge him his outlet. Lindsay and me? Well, we lost ourselves in video games. There was relief in disappearing into fictional worlds where we had some illusion of control, and we did our level best to make this happen. We were too conscientious to ever succeed completely, though. As much as it was tempting to hide from the world, there were a lot of people hurting out there in our lives, and we had to be there for them as best we could. I think Lindsay and I both enjoyed finally being old enough to help prop up our parents when they needed us, and in this unprecedented time, we did a pretty good job, I think. And then there was Will. Will was the odd one out of our group. You see, Riley and Marco and Lindsay and me, we were the oddballs and the nerds, the outcasts at whatever school we attended and bonded in our mutual unpopularity, considering ourselves an outside elite, secretly better than the real popular kids. Will was never like that, though. While we were proudly the weird ones, Will was pretty much Captain America. The big, blonde, popular athlete. On principle, I think we all would have hated him if we'd only met him for the first time in high school. But with the five of us having history leading back to second grade, Will was always one of us. He was the responsible one. The one who kept us goofballs in line and made sure we kept out of trouble. And while he didn't always succeed, his intentions were always appreciated. Whenever Will had a game, you can sure as hell bet that we would be there cheering him on, even if we never really got all the rules to football. And when he ran for junior class president, you can bet we made an enthusiastic campaign team. Will was a good guy. Dare I say, some might even call him a goody-two-shoes. He was a guy whose understanding of life was that there were rules in this great country we lived in, and that they were meant to be followed, and if you followed them well enough, you would be rewarded in life. Something as wholly unexpected and terrible as 9/11. That really fucked Will up. His understanding of the order of the world was shaken, and in those few months afterward, he was overcome by the twin demons of rage and grief. So much so that it was difficult to be his friend at times. We wanted to be there for him, needed to be there for him, but between those moments where he was crying uncontrollably or lashing out in anger in that particularly jingoistic way that so many had after the attacks, we started to avoid him. In retrospect, it was cruel of us, but with our limited understandings of mental health and the need to keep on going ourselves in a very confusing time, it seemed the only option. With his 17th birthday right around the corner in early January, Will seemed to be getting darker by the day. Christmas and New Year's, typically joyous times, only brought him deeper and deeper into his pit, and it felt like his birthday might finally put him in a hole so deep and dark we wouldn't be able to save him. Though we were pulling away from him, I think we all had an unspoken hope that it wasn't a permanent thing. There was still too much history, too much love to have us want to leave him completely alone. And so we talked about what we could do that might cheer him up. And I came up with what seemed like the most brilliant idea of my 16 years of life. We take him to the mall. This wouldn't be just any mall trip, though. No, this was going to be the ultimate mall trip. We'd take him out to lunch, and dinner, and shopping, and to a movie. But most importantly of all, we would be spending the majority of the day at his favorite part of the mall, the Silver Metal Laser Fun Center. With a massive arcade, bowling lanes, and a fairly spacious laser tag course, it seemed like if anything could get Will out of his funk, it would be this. In my defense, it really seemed like a good idea at the time. Through the eyes of a 2002 teenager who hadn't been exposed to much outside of his small-town life, I couldn't imagine things got much better than the Silver Metal Laser Fun Center. The laser tag course was dark and smoky, with plenty of obstacles to hide behind, pounding techno music that threatened to make your ears bleed, and plenty of spinning, criss-crossing laser lights to dazzle whatever senses you had that hadn't already been overwhelmed. Though the entrance to the laser tag course seemed so small from the outside, once you were within it, it was practically a whole new world, unfolding and expanding seemingly into oblivion, far larger on the inside than it could possibly have been on the outside. Another mystery of the Braywood Courtyard Shopping Center, or just another quirk of memory? Who knows? What I can say for a fact, though, was that Will and Riley and Marco and Lindsay and me, we'd spent a lot of time hunting each other and being hunted by each other in that loud, dark chamber, and formed a lot of the fonder memories of my young existence in there. Of course, it wasn't all fun and games at the Silver Medal. Many of our games ended in arguments and fights, and that time Marco's girlfriend broke up with him just before a game, I can't say I'm terribly proud of the petty cruelty the rest of us stooped to in our misguided attempt to avenge his broken heart. That was just us being stupid teenagers, though. At the end of the day, we were able to make peace with each other and call ourselves friends again. There was no evil in these interactions. In us. No. The evil of the silver medal pretty well came from Roland Buckman. Roland was their assistant manager. A tall, skinny, pale guy with a thin mustache and blocky glasses. He claimed to be 23, even though he looked closer to being 33, but whether that's because he was a liar or because he was prematurely aged by working at the mall was anyone's guess. He walked with a limping right leg and spoke in a high voice that was prone to stammering, and if he weren't such a tool, we might have felt a little bad for him, but since he was, we didn't. If you were a guy, he wasn't that much trouble. He was just a dweeb who'd tell you what to do and what not to do on the laser tag course with a little too much belief in his own power granted by his position. Before every game, he'd try to stare us down no matter how much taller most of us were than him, clapping his hands on his hips and saying, "Well, boys, here's the rules, and you best pay attention, because I'm only saying them once," no matter how many times we'd heard them from him before. And if you really annoyed him, he might call you his favorite insult in the world. Pissant. If you were a girl, though... I didn't think much of it in the beginning, but I should have seen it. I thought, since he didn't seem to bother Riley, and she was a girl, that the rumors were being blown out of proportion, that Lindsay was making a mountain out of a molehill. She was cute, after all, in her own nerdy way. All of us guys had crushes on her at one point or another, and why should Roland be any different? The way Lindsay described him watching her, how he'd always try to chat her up and made her feel uncomfortable when putting on her laser tag vest? At the time, it seemed the stupid sort of courtship that movies taught us to expect. I didn't find out for some years that he was like this with all the pretty girls who were a couple years shy of 18, and that the police had considered him a person of interest in quite a few worse dealings. I should have listened to Lindsay from the start. I should have listened. And I shouldn't have planned the party at the Silver Medal. I shouldn't. There are so many things I shouldn't have done, honestly. Things I shouldn't have done but did, and now we're all stuck with what happened. Sorry, I'm getting off track, aren't I? Let's get back to the party. The first steps of Will's party went off without a hitch. We were able to kidnap him from his family for the night, with his parents' help, of course. And when we took off the blindfold and pushed him into the silver medal with us, I might well have seen some smiles from him. The smiles were definitely there after our first couple games of laser tag, where it seemed, rather mercifully, that Roland wasn't working for the night. And by the time we were all sweaty and out of breath and retired to one of the silver medal's small party rooms for pizza, cake, and soda, things almost felt normal. It didn't change the global tragedy that hung over all of us. But for a little while, we didn't let it control a single one of us. We were glad to have Will back, and it looked like he was too. It was in this joy where we first let our guards down. That's the mall's way of driving you crazy, I think. If you're really looking for it to do something dramatic and strange to prove to someone what it can do, it won't do anything. But if you're careless, well, that's when it starts to misbehave. After the cake was finished, we moved our celebration into the arcade. While not nearly as large as the laser tag arena, it was utterly packed with every game you could want, from Pac-Man to Centipede, Mortal Kombat to Polybius, and everything in between. Mixed in with the video games were your arcade standards, your basketball games, your skee-ball and air hockey. It was a room full of noise and promise, and a place that I always looked forward to visiting. Riley and Marco split off from our group, saying they were going to go play some Street Fighter, but given how they'd been making eyes at each other lately, I know I wasn't the only one who thought they were splitting off to finally make out. I had promised Will we'd have first game when we got to the arcade, and I meant to hold to it, but while he was scouting things out, Lindsay pulled me aside. "Can I talk to you real quick?" she asked, biting her lip nervously. "Sure," I said, looking over my shoulder at Will. Lindsay nodded. "It's just... do you mind if I stick close to you guys? I could really use the company." Now, I loved Lindsay's company, but having promised Will some time, I knew what that really meant was some guy time. Still, that didn't mean I missed the anxiety in her voice. "What's wrong?" I asked. You know what's wrong. Who's wrong? Lindsay said, looking around as if she were being hunted. He's not here, I said, trying to calm her. We would have seen him by now if he were here. He'd make sure you could see him. The look she gave me said my attempts at calming her were pretty piss poor. I can feel him, she said. I don't know if he's here or if it just feels like it because he's here all the time, but there's something wrong, something sticky to this place, and him and... Please? Can I just stick with you and Will? You can do whatever you want, play whatever you want. I'm not going to beg quarters off you or anything, but... I'm seriously kind of freaking out here and could really use the support. Please? I've got the mace my mom gave me, but I don't want to have to use it, and... I don't want him showing me any more pictures. She was talking about the incident a few months earlier that had finally started me on the road toward understanding what a creep Roland really was. Before all the global nightmares had taken over our world, Lindsay had hung back in the arcade one day while the rest of us played a round of laser tag. Apparently, Roland had taken this as an indication that she must have been in a dejected mood being left alone, and had gathered up a number of pictures from bikini magazines that he claimed looked like Lindsay. He'd said he thought this would cheer her up, but instead it sent Lindsay running so far into the mall it took us the better portion of an hour to find her after our game. After she explained what had happened, I never doubted Lindsay again. But even with this knowledge, the whole situation didn't feel like more than we could handle together. Will had set up shop at a nearby arcade cabinet and was waving me over. Seeing his game of choice, I grinned, not just for myself but for Lindsay as well, since she usually loved cheering us on as we played. No problem. We got your back, I said, leading Lindsay along with me. Just hang by us, and we'll keep you safe. Lindsay followed closely, but still seemed uncertain as she eyed the cabinet for the Lost World Jurassic Park game that Will had claimed for us. She knew well how intense Will and I got when playing the game, and my promise didn't seem to fill her with the greatest confidence in her safety. I tried to play damage control and added, "We won't be more than half an hour, I promise. And then... then we can get out of here." This perked up Lindsay's interest. "Yeah?" I answered, "Yeah, promise. Will and I have gotten really fucking good at this one. Bet you we'll set a high score tonight." Lindsay rolled her eyes. "My heroes." I shrugged. "Yeah, it's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it." Lindsay punched me in the shoulder, but she was smiling, so that was something. I took my seat in the black, green, and yellow arcade cabinet beside Will. He had already claimed the blue gun, my favorite, but given that this was his birthday, I didn't begrudge him his choice of weapons, picking the red plastic gun up for myself. Surrounded by the speakers and the imposing physical frame of the game, it was easy to get lost and imagine we were stepping aboard a vehicle that would soon take us through the ruins and monsters that lurked at Site B. "You loaded us up?" I asked, holding my gun up in a toast. "Quarters are in." "Locked and loaded?" Will asked, tapping his gun to mine and trying his best to sound like an action movie hero. I smiled, thrusting my gun in the air and pointing it at the screen, putting on my own best action hero voice when I said, "Let's do this." Leaning in slightly on my side of the cabinet, Lindsay rolled her eyes at our stupid attempts to be macho, but when Will wasn't looking, quickly tipped me a wink and a quiet thank you. I nodded back at her, and then let the game wash over me. Now, I'll never claim that the arcade version of The Lost World Jurassic Park is the greatest video game ever made, with its threadbare plot and graphics that were pretty janky even for 2002, but it was pretty damn fun as on-rails light gun arcade shooters went. By the time of his birthday party, it felt like Will and I had sunk enough quarters into this one to probably buy the actual cabinet, which meant by this night, we were playing the best game we had ever played. We easily mowed through armies of raptors, spitters, and combies, saving innocent hunters and even dodging the falling crap of the Mimenchosaurus with the help of our tranquilizer guns. The bosses fell before us with equal ease, with the female T-Rex not even getting in a bite, the pair of Dinosuchus at the lake feeling utterly inadequate in front of our superior firepower, and even the invisible Carnotaurus not proving a challenge before our skill. Will and I were on fire this night, the two of us cheering and high-fiving at every save screen, probably getting louder and sounding dumber with every digital victory we garnered. For a while there, Lindsay was cheering with us, or reaching in to offer tips or heads up on any dinosaurs we might have missed. But after a while, we were so in the zone that even she disappeared. It was just the two of us, our guns, and everything falling before us. In just over 20 minutes, we reached the final boss, the male T-Rex. And when he fell before our victorious might, you might have thought we were celebrating VJ Day for how much the two of us cheered. I had never felt this kind of elation in my life, the sheer and simple joy of having brought Will back from the brink, if just for a little while. And briefly, I was saddened by the simple fact that we were soon going to be reclaimed by the real world. For in our victory, we would soon come to the end credits, and after that... Except this time, the end credits didn't roll. No, this time we got a simple map graphic like any other in the game preparing us to enter Stage 6. Stage 6? Will asked. There's no Stage 6. Maybe there is, I said, filled with a new joy. The joy of discovery. Maybe this is like secret content because we played the game so well? Like Reptile or Akuma or Smoke. We may have just found something nobody else has ever seen. Will's eyes lit up like a kid on Christmas morning. Wow. While the screen may have flickered and certainly lingered longer on the map segment leading us to Stage 6 than usual, once the music kicked in, it didn't feel like anything was wrong. No, it felt like we were explorers about to identify and study a newly discovered ancient civilization, or perhaps walk on a new planet. Yes, this day was turning out better than I possibly could have imagined. The graphics on the new level were slightly better, as was the sound, as we took on a new river level that had been added to the game. As soon as I saw the newly colorful raptors, this unexpected level made sense. Someone had somehow added some areas based on Jurassic Park 3 into the mix. This was only confirmed by our first new boss fight against the Spinosaurus. It didn't look quite like it did in the movie, but it was massive and was easily the hardest boss fight yet, requiring split-second reflexes and well-timed reloads. But it wasn't beyond our skill. We got hit more than usual, but made it through with health to spare because we had each other's backs. Stage 7 wasn't far behind, this time taking us into the massive domed aviary as we fought off waves of pteranodons. This level was by far the scariest we had played, with dinosaurs hiding in the misty, creaky catwalks and popping out of nowhere. Their screeches were louder, more real, almost as if they were right beside us. The violence, too, was more pronounced, with bursts of blood and shrieks of pain from every dinosaur we shot down. The aviary was also decorated with mangled, partially eaten bodies of the Pteranodon's previous victims, some of them reaching out to us and asking for our help. Even as someone who was into horror, this felt unsettling and off in such a familiar and kid-friendly game, and I could see that even Will was beginning to get uncomfortable. After defeating a great Quetzalcoatlus and watching the magnificent, shrieking beast plummet to its bloody death in the canyon below, I was tempted to ask if Will might want to quit soon and try a different game, but we were on a strange kind of autopilot. I knew that what was happening was upsetting to both of us, but there was nothing I could do to stop it, not when we still had quarters, not when we were on this kind of a roll. We couldn't possibly quit now. Could we? The next level took us into a section of Site B that was just marked by a bloody, scratched sign that said, The Pit, but it looked more like another abandoned laboratory. As we ventured deeper into the building, it was eerily quiet. No raptors, no bosses, nothing but bloody cages with bars broken outward. Bodies lay on the floor, some of them human, some of them dinosaur, some of them merely twisted, bloody flesh, unidentifiable as anything that once lived. Uncomfortably, Will said, What the f... At this, one of the digitized bodies shrieked and grabbed for us, startling both Will and me. The bloodied man had somehow been horribly fused with a velociraptor in some twisted medical procedure, parts crudely stitched to his mangled body. With his shrieking, growling voice, he begged for us to kill him, that he was in so much pain. Aiming circles appeared on the screen, encouraging us to shoot him in the neck and chest. And though instinct demanded that I should, I couldn't. Will nearly did, but he too dropped his gun down not long before a big failed message appeared on the screen. There were no more enemies before our next screen of stats popped up, indicating our accuracy and kill count for the level. "I don't know if I want to keep on playing," I said, finally, but couldn't quite get myself to move. "I know," Will answered. Maybe when we run out of health. Maybe then we quit?" "Yeah," I answered. That sounded like a plausible plan and didn't mean that we were suddenly chickening out. "Yeah, then we can play something else." "Yeah," Will agreed. The next level started with us simply staring at a pair of doors for a very long time with no music, no sound. The anticipation was maddening, bolstered by our mutual decision to leave, almost as if the game wanted us to stay here. After maybe a minute of this, I could have sworn that the game had frozen, but testing things out with my gun, I found we were still able to shoot and reload. I was about to suggest that we just let it be and leave when the doors burst outward toward us, and all hell was unleashed. The lab we were in now looked much like the pit, but was no longer filled by the dead and dying. These half-human, half-dinosaur abominations were very much alive, very much ambulatory, and they were out to get us. Screaming the screams of damned souls, they shrieked and begged for us to put them out of their misery as they attacked us. Dutifully, as years of video games had taught us, we shot every single one of them that crossed our path with mechanical efficiency, even though their cries of pain and relief were slowly tearing away at parts of the back of my mind as easily as our guns tore their limbs graphically from their bodies. I looked to Will, who now had tears in his eyes, but neither of us could stop. We had come so far, we still had our quarters, and we were doing so well. We went through level after level of increasing horror as more savagely depraved and twisted beasts threw themselves at us, and we tore them apart limb from limb with our guns. I couldn't say how long those quarters lasted, but we were agents of death and chaos, massacring everything in our path, even though we had long since stopped wanting to do this. My heart was beating so heavily I thought it would rip out of my chest by the time we got to that final boss. A great octopus-looking beast made up of screaming humans stitched to screaming dinosaurs. All of them mechanized by some great robotic framework, proudly bearing the InGen logo that perversely made this feel connected to the main canon. Kindly old Mr. Hammond stood by on the sidelines, tossing us health and encouraging us in our fight against this monstrosity, which was of some comfort, but the moment the beast got one of its fleshy tentacles around the old man, his demeanor changed. Hammond screamed as he stared into the creature's one great eye, peeling his face off as if to prevent the creature from getting it and begging for us to flee. Finally, the monster grabbed our avatars in its tentacles, pulling them closer to its twisting, greasy, screaming mouth. Will snapped moments before I could, screaming and throwing his gun at the screen, shattering it. We couldn't see how things ended for the spider-webbed plastic and glass, but the game over music was suddenly very familiar, almost threatening to break our sanity as Will had broken the screen as we were returned to the real world. Will and I looked at each other, both of us with tears streaming from our eyes as we laughed in horrible relief. We reached for each other, grasping hands together as we understood the nightmare to be over. "Well, that was something else, wasn't it?" Will asked, trying to make his laugh sound more real than it was allowing itself to be. "Yeah, yeah. Maybe some of these secrets are better off not found, aren't they?" I asked, finding it hard to catch my breath. "Yeah," Will said, looking at the roll of quarters he'd broken open. "Why don't we see what the others are doing?" "Good idea," I said, perhaps too quickly. "And maybe we should..." A hand grasped my shoulder, and I screamed a terribly undignified scream. Hey, it's just me," Lindsay said, looking through the side of the car at us. Her eyes were terribly concerned as she took us in, her hand insistent on my shoulder. I was breathing heavily, barely able to put coherent thoughts together, but since words came more easily to me than they did to Will, I said, "Hi, Lindsay." Frightened, I'm not sure if it was for us or of us, Lindsay replied. "What the hell happened to you guys in there?" "What do you mean?" I asked. Looking around what I realized was a much emptier silver medal, Lindsay replied, "You were playing that game for almost 3 hours. I thought you were about to lose it." 3 hours? Will said, arching his neck to look out of the cabinet. "That couldn't have been 3 hours. Fearfully, Lindsay showed me her watch. I said, "Oh, fuck. She's right." We gotta get out of here," Will said. "Mall's closing soon." "No shit," Lindsay said, gingerly helping me to my feet. "What the hell happened to you two in there? You just kept playing the game over and over again like robots. I mean, how many times can you guys beat a T-Rex?" "That wasn't," I murmured, remembering distinctly the horrible things I saw in the game. "Didn't you see the monsters?" "Only the same damn dinosaurs over and over," Lindsay said. "I get that it's a fun game, but it's not that fun, right?" I looked to Will with great need, wanting to make sure that I wasn't the only one who saw what happened with that game. As he had that same haunted look that I was sure I did, I knew this to be true, but whether or not that made this better, I couldn't say. Why didn't you try to stop us?" I asked Lindsay. A strange, unsettled, and shadowy look overcame her face. I don't know. I wanted to stop you, but every time I started to, I didn't. My breathing was suddenly getting rather hectic. Something happened, I said. It was all that I could say, the closest I could get to understanding just what the hell had occurred. Will got up on shaky feet and walked around the cabinet toward us. The silver medal was effectively empty, the sounds of games playing on their own our only true company. Seeing the state the both of us were in, Lindsay cautiously said, "Riley and Marco are outside smoking, waiting for us. We should leave." "Yeah," I agreed. "Leaving sounds good," Will said. With Will and me on unsteady feet, Lindsay guided us toward the exit. The silver medal felt strange. Alien, even, after what had happened to us in the game. The games felt like they were closing in on us, almost like, well, like some of those zombies from Dawn of the Dead. Even though she hadn't seen what we saw in the game, Lindsay guided us a little faster as if she was feeling something too. By the time we saw the front door, she was nearly frantic, pushing us into a run toward the shadowy front exit of the arcade. We weren't fast enough. Not to escape the silver medal, and certainly not to avoid Roland Buckman sliding into the shadows in front of us. "Welp," Roland said, dropping his hands to his hips in his usual approximation of an authoritative stance. "We got us a mighty big pickle, kiddies. You're in a whole heap of trouble I can't even begin to describe." "We didn't do anything," Lindsay said, her voice rising with anger. Pushing his glasses up the bridge of his nose, Roland stepped into the light. Though the man had always looked off, tonight he looked horrible. His eyes were sunken in, and there were a few graying sores around his mouth and on his neck. His mustache looked thinner than usual, and his teeth, when he would show them, looked yellower and sharper. "Well now, that's not exactly the full truth, is it?" Roland said, taking another step toward Lindsay. Will and I stepped slightly in front of her, protective, but only able to do so much in our weakened state. "It is. We didn't do anything," Lindsay protested. "No!" Roland shouted, stamping his bad leg down hard enough that I could feel it through the floor. "No. You will not be lying to my face. I didn't work this hard and come this far to get lied to by little piss ants like you. You kids were bad. You were very, very bad. And there will be punishments." Weakly, I asked, What do you think we did?" Roland straightened himself up importantly, saying, "You broke a very, very expensive arcade game, didn't you? Yeah, when Mr. High and Mighty Birthday Boy with the blue gun thought throwing it would be more fun than shooting it? Remember that?" What little color Will's face had left drained from it. I couldn't blame him since, well, that was something we had definitely done wrong. "Look," Will said, stepping forward, "I can explain. It was an accident, and my parents will be happy to..." With a speed and strength I wouldn't have expected from his skinny frame, Roland shot a fist out toward Will's face, catching him hard in the cheek. The impact was sickening, and Will was out cold on the floor within the second. I screamed. Lindsay reached in her pocket for her mace, but Roland was faster, grabbing her by the throat, lifting her off the ground, and tossing her into a nearby arcade cabinet. I stood rooted to my spot, my legs weak and shaky as the Silver Metal Laser Fun Center's assistant manager looked me straight in the eye with that same annoyed look on his face, huffing and putting his hands back on his hips. "You break the game and then you attack me?" he stated, rocking back and forth on his feet. "Welp, I'm going to have to take you all to security, you know that, right? I got to take you pissants there and fill out a whole lot of paperwork, and let me say you're ruining my whole fucking evening." For someone who loved saying what characters in scary movies should have done, the irony of being frozen in place by sheer terror of Roland Buckman and completely unable to run wasn't lost on me. He bent over, hefting Will over his shoulder and standing up with frightening ease. "Welp, you gonna help me carry your pretty little friend up to security, or am I gonna have to do this the hard way?" Roland asked. This would have been the perfect moment to do something heroic. I could have fought, or run away screaming for help. I could have saved them, us, a whole lot of terror by simply doing anything in this moment. Instead, I said, "Huh?" Roland sighed and said, "Little pissants, always making me do this the hard way." At that, he cocked his free hand back into a fist and swung at me. I felt the impact, briefly, but didn't feel much more as I dropped into complete and utter darkness. In my fading consciousness, a foolishly hopeful part of me wanted this to be it, for someone to see and stop Roland before the nightmare metastasized into true horror. We wouldn't be that lucky.
This story will conclude in our next episode. The Last Time I Went to the Mall Part 1 is a work of fiction written and performed by Matt Carter. Real-world products and properties mentioned in this story belong to their respective copyright holders. Narration provided by Fiona J.R. Tichenel. The Shadow Storyteller's theme written and performed by Dennis Tichenel. The Shadow Storyteller's artwork by Kristen McQuiggan of Drop Dead Designs. This episode was edited by Fiona J.R. Tichenel and Matt Carter. For more information on the Shadow Storytellers podcast and our other fiction works, please visit our website at theshadowstorytellers.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe for more information on upcoming episodes. We hope you had fun, and we'll see you next time for this story's conclusion.